skill and intelligence, could learn to be a doctor, or could learn to be a teacher, or could learn to be an auto mechanic, but that somehow writing is in a special category, and it is off limits to anybody. And no matter how many creative writing courses you take, if you don't have it, you can't do it. And literally, I suppose, the other nine questions really sort of arise out of that first question. My own specific interest in creative writing is the teaching of it, and I might simply fill you in before turning it over to Gene, who's taken a specific creative writing course, which might make the basis for discussion. I might talk about the two theories that are current in the teaching, not only of creative writing, but of any kind of writing. And that's, of course, another question. Is there any other writing than creative writing? Or is all good writing creative? But the two theories, and you will see, I hope, as I explain this, where your own educations have fit into this, and it may be responsible for the muddle in the field of writing today. Students, according to all the tests, and according to all teachers and most parents, are writing more miserably than they ever were before, and they're reading more miserably. I was talking on the way out here at a conference in Bozeman, Montana, to an editor for John Wiley and Company, one of the largest textbook publishing companies, and all new editions of texts that Wiley is coming out with and other publishers have moved down. These are college textbooks, have moved down from the 12th grade reading level to the 11th grade reading level, and the books that Wiley is projecting now for 1984 and 85 are being done at the 8th grade reading level for college. And if Wiley sinks millions of dollars, as they are, into the gamble that reading is and writing is going to deteriorate to that level in our colleges, you can bet that they've got some kind of firm evidence back of it. At any rate, the two theories, very, very quickly, are, first of all, I suppose, a theory we might call Greek, and the second one we might call Romantic. The Greeks believed that a human being, a baby, was not really human, but was merely an animal with the capacity to become human if one trained that humanity into him. Left to himself, he would simply become a barbarian, a beast, a nothing. That he wasn't really anything but potentially human, which is why the Greeks, of course, left babies out that they didn't want out on the hillside to die. You weren't really killing a human being, you were only killing an animal who might become a human being. You became a human by becoming civilized, by having the state and the parents take care of you and educate you rigorously with discipline. You sat down and memorized and repeated and imitated and learned the skill of writing, of reading, of arithmetic, and so forth. And finally you reached the point at which you were civilized. But it wasn't something natural to human beings. That's the kind of writing that, and the kind of theory of teaching, I think, that I grew up in the late 40s and early 50s. And really, I suppose, has been a part of Western culture almost down to that point. That you really learn to be a good citizen or a lady or a gentleman by having teachers tell you what to do, by memorizing the rules of punctuation, by memorizing spelling words, and by looking at good examples of writing and imitating them, kind of patterning yourself. In other words, by discipline and by rules, if you look at number four. On the other hand, in 1963, for no reason that I could think of, except that one of my students suggested it might have been the assassination of Kennedy that started the whole generation of the 60s, but in 1963, a new theory came into existence that really had been invented long before by the Romantic poets, and that is that a person is naturally good, he is naturally human, naturally civil, naturally loving and caring and so forth, and that where he goes wrong, it is because rules have made him into a machine, and that the best way of teaching a person not only to be a human, but the best way of teaching a person to write is to somehow get him rid of his hang-ups. Let him escape rules. Let it all hang out. Free him from his fear of what people are going to think of what he writes. Almost the reverse, in other words, of what the Greeks believed made a person a good writer and a good person. And until, I suppose, 74 or 75, most of your children have been raised in this kind of a school system, in which creativity, imagination is urged, in which, at its extreme at least, there are textbooks, I should have brought a couple along with me tonight, in which there are textbooks which suggest don't put any red mark on a paper that a student has written, because you're stifling his imagination. If he wants to say it that way, let him say it that way. Maybe it isn't quite understandable. Maybe it is grammatically wrong. But after all, it's his thing. It's the way he wants to say it. And if you put a red mark on his paper, you're simply a policeman trying to regiment him. And you will stifle his creativity. Well, obviously you can see these are two quite opposite methods. Do you teach creative writing, in other words, as a teacher, by getting that student the way you would train a doctor, by having him practice and show him and have him go through the motions until he can do it with skill? Or do you teach him to write by literally getting out of the way and not telling him, refusing him to tell him, throw him out on his own, or giving him assignments that are close to what we would call sensitivity training, to get him to see and touch and taste and smell and get him over his dependence on rigid rules? Well, the results, of course, as they're showing up on tests, indicate that as a result of this 10 years of creative writing that we have had, students are writing more poorly. But you have to keep in mind that well may be the test at fault, that the test is trying to show something far too regimented and rigid and organized, and the people that may be failing are the test makers and not your students in school. That is, their writing may be coming more imaginative and more alive and really more creative, and in a test designed only to test something that isn't really important. Okay, at any rate, that it seems to me is what's implied, depending upon which side you take in number one with Coleridge's "Poets are born, not made." If poets are born, then as a writing teacher or as a creative writer, you somehow have to get out of the way and get rid of your hang-ups. If poets can be made, then the Greeks are probably right with their system of order and discipline. The Greeks really began, and I have tried both of these ways out in groups of students, and I guess what succeeds with some doesn't succeed with others, but neither was a total success or a total failure. But there is a modern book called Classical Rhetoric for the Modern Student, a freshman English text, in which the first two assignments are simply picking passages from great stylists of the English language, Hemingway, for instance, or Steinbeck, and copying page after page after page, with the feeling, as the Greeks did, that if you got into the habit of writing good prose, a little of it would rub off on you. Then the next three assignments are imitating. You pick somebody, John Donne, let's say, and you imitate his style. You write your own essay, but you imitate John Donne. You're still, you see, just a fledgling person, and you're doing it like the masters did it. And only at the very end of the course do you have the ability and the skill, at least according to this system, to go out on your own. And then you're writing your own thing. But by that time, you've become so immersed in the language, in good language, in writing good language, that hopefully you do it yourself. Well, teachers whom we have produced since 1963 are horrified at this kind of regimentation. I mean, you're just constricting the student. You're teaching him to write good prose, but it's Hemingway's prose or Steinbeck's prose, and not his own thing or his own voice. That's really all I have to say by way of an introduction. And if you do have questions, I don't know why you various people are at this session, whether you want to talk about creative writing or how to do it, or whether you have ideas, or whether you have things yourself. I know a couple of you have brought things to share, and if a lot of you have, we can continue these sessions on an informal basis and simply turn this into a kind of writer's club and discuss each other's writings. But this ought to provide at least a little kind of background for the course that that Jean had, and it will become clear, I think, as she describes the course and then goes on to talk about her own writing and how she writes, it ought to become clear, you know, what side of the fence that particular course was on. Go ahead, Jean.
I prepared the longer part of the two sheets as very practical advice in how to get started to write a novel. Now, this is primarily a course in novel writing. If it was poetry or short stories or technical material, it might be quite different. But I was rather appalled to find out that you needed 4 drafts, particularly since you are required to write 100,000 words. So that in the event you do get an editor to read it, and in the event he does want to publish it, he can use his editorial prerogative and cut a good many of those 100,000 words. The subjects that were presented, as you can see from these many questions in the center part, are things that get down to gut issues. This is what good writers write about, and this is what basically most readers want to read about. The things that frighten you, your emotions, the hate, the envy, the things that made you feel good, the peak experiences. I might add too, I've been analyzing novels for some years now, and finding that more and more novels are really beefed up movie scripts. I found out when my editor explained to me that very little money is made by the average first book writer on the hardback. Only about $5,000 is made on the paperback, but where the money comes in is when you sell it to the movies, if you're that fortunate. A beginning writer can expect $40,000 from the movies. A writer with a little more reputation can expect $100,000. And on up to the top people. So this is really where literature is being pointed today, much of it, in the direction of selling it as a movie script. The last part of this was quite important, again, in knowing how to begin, where to begin. You have to have a central character. You have to have the opposing force of the novel so that you have a protagonist and antagonist, so there is friction, so there is something that has to be solved. And then the third vital character can be one or more, the commentator type who serves to explain, illustrate, and comment, so on. I am basically a storyteller. I am not a scholar, and I don't pretend to be one. I hope to learn to be a good storyteller. And this novel that I have written, the first book I wrote was a book of 9 months of travel that I did with a backpack and bedroll, starting at Singapore and working my way back overland across the country. I ended up in Africa and liked it so much that I returned there again last year. So in my novel, since I couldn't get the travel book published because the editors all said travel books don't sell, I used the East African background for my novel to give it an exotic touch, which is kind of nice to be able to use it and still not come up with a travel book. The book opens, basically, the protagonist is an ex-mercenary named Blake, who is trapping birds in Tanzania, and a sort of middle 30-ish housewife type whose husband owns a pet shop in Liverpool, England, has come to Africa with her 15-year-old son to buy some parakeets. They're getting short on the market, and this too was an opportunity for her to see something of Africa. So she meets Blake, the protagonist, to talk about buying the birds from him, and he in turn invites her and her son to go with him on safari to actually trap the birds. Of course, she leaps at the opportunity. which also begins a romance between the two. And so this is just a portion of what happens to them when they're on safari. That would be Blake, Penny, and Penny's 15-year-old son, Alfred. When they returned to camp, they found a visitor. Blake increased his pace and shook hands vigorously with a tall, blonde Norwegian. "Lars, it's been an age," he turned to introduce Penny. "Mrs. Lampert Smith and her son Alfred, this is my old friend and partner in crime, Lars Andreessen." They shook hands all around and settled into folding camp chairs, drinks in hand. "Blake," said Lars, leaning forward in his chair, "I want to get into old times with you later, but right now I have a problem, one that may appear at any moment." Lars' blue eyes were so light a blue they seemed to have been part of the glaciers of his homeland. He had the fair complexion of the Scandinavian that only reddened and burnt but never tanned. His eyelashes were so bleached from the sun as to be almost invisible. He had a crop of abundant sun-bleached hair that he ran his fingers through often, but which sprang up as if on wires. His jaw was square below a slightly hooked but aquiline nose. "Righto," Blake replied. "What's the trouble? Incidentally, where are you camped? All I see is your car and your gun boy." "I'm about 6 or 8 miles east of you," Lars said hurriedly, running his hand through his springy hair again. "I'm between contracts, still a mercenary, you know, so I thought I'd do a bit of hunting while there's something left to shoot. I've got a license for the Big Three and had only the leopard left. To make a long story short, we had the blind all set up and the bait hanging just right, but when the leopard showed up and I took a shot at him, he moved and I only wounded him. We tracked him next day and he'd gone into thick grass. I don't know yet where he came from, but he went straight for my hunter and nearly took his scalp off, and he went clean over his head. Then he was gone. We got the hunter to the bush airstrip and on his way to Nairobi. They're sending me another one in a few days. I still hope to find that leopard. Don't like the idea of his being out there mad as all hell. But I can see," he laughed, "why those chaps cross the earth and live like kings, though it could as well have been him, me as him, I suppose." "So what's your problem?" asked Blake. Lars glanced uneasily at Penny. "Well," he shifted his chair closer to Blake's and lowered his voice, "you see, it's this girl." Blake's laugh exploded in the soft African twilight. "I've never known a girl to throw you, Lars." Blake turned to Penny. "We used to call him the Scandinavian stud in the old days." Blake turned back to Lars. "What is it? Some wench you've buggered about and now she's after you with a pistol?" "It's not exactly a girl, Blake," Lars shifted uncomfortably. "What do you mean, not exactly a girl? Either she is or she isn't," Blake continued to chuckle. "Damn it, Blake," Lars smiled and relaxed a bit. "No, I mean, it's a Maasai girl." "Oh, a Maasai in it. What are you messing around with a Maasai maiden for? Don't you know you can get into big trouble that way out here in the bush?" "Blake," Lars expostulated, "I'm not messing around, as you so inelegantly put it. She's just there all the time." "Lars," Blake said with mock seriousness, "maybe you had better start at the beginning and let's get the straight of it." "All right," Lars sighed and leaned back in his chair. When I say she's there, that's just what I mean. She loped into camp shortly after the white hunter left, came to a dead halt when she saw me, and has dogged my footsteps ever since. None of the safari boys speak Maasai, so I can't find out what she wants. She squats in front of my tent when I go to bed at night, and no matter how often I wake and look out, she's right there. When I get up in the morning, it doesn't look as if she's moved." Lars extended his glass for a refill and paused until he'd had a long swallow. "I've tried losing her when we take the car out in the bush, but she can lope along at 15 miles an hour for miles and doesn't seem to get winded at all. Even when I'm able to go faster, it's just a matter of time before she shows up. And you know how they are, Blake." Lars' nose crinkled slightly. "I mean, she's a gorgeous hunk of female, near 6 feet tall and graceful as a gazelle, but, well, I can feel her eyes on me all the time. She just stares. I mean, it's getting to me." Lars glanced apologetically at Penny and Alfred. "I know. Don't tell me," Blake nodded. "Her head's shaved and her whole body's covered with animal fat mixed with red ochre and there's flies all over." Lars nodded with relief and combed his fingers through his unruly hair again. Also, I don't know when an irate husband or father, or maybe the whole tribe, will descend on me. I thought you might speak the language, and I think I'll have the chance to do that just now, Blake commented, his lips tight. He pointed to a spot just outside the circle of light. It took the others a moment to adjust to the darkness, and then they could make out only a vague shadow. She did a good job tracking you after dark, Blake said, rising. He turned toward the shadow and spoke a few words in a strange guttural monotone. Slowly the figure emerged from the shadows and seemed to glide the distance into the circle of campfire light. I'm using my carbon copy and it sometimes is not very clear. Penny drew in her breath sharply as she looked at the girl. She stood erect, head held proud, as only a member of a free and never conquered people can. Her copper-oiled body danced as the flames reflected off it, sending color to the edge of darkness. Long beaded earrings hung suspended from the tips of her ears as well as her earlobes. The ends barely cleared the massive necklace around her long, slender throat and stretched from shoulder to shoulder, stopping just above her nipples. Her breasts were extremely firm to be so prominent. They jutted out from her torso, pointed as spears. A short beaded apron slung low about her hips covered only the front of her. Her buttocks were high and rounded, taut as a drum. Her eyes were on Lars until Blake spoke, then she looked at Blake's face, direct and unblinking. After a number of exchanges in that strange guttural language, Blake turned to the others and said, "Above all, don't laugh, don't even smile. A maiden scorned is not taken lightly with these people any more than with our own." He turned back to look again at the Maasai. The other's eyes followed him. The girl's face showed no expression. The bridge of her nose completed a straight line from forehead to tip with no indentation. Her cheekbones were high and her mouth chiseled. She looked as Egyptian as a pharaoh's daughter. Indeed, probably was descended from them. She stood utterly motionless, only her eyes moved from face to face. "Did you find out what she wants?" Lars said in the edge of his chair. "Yes," Blake replied, "but as I warned you, not even a smile, all right?" Lars nodded, holding his breath. "She says," Blake took a deep breath, "that you are the most beautiful man she has ever seen. She wants to marry you. She asks, now watch it," Blake commanded with his voice, looking hard at the three of them. "She wants to know how many cattle will you give her father for her?" Blake turned his head to the Maasai, his face twitching as he fought for control. After a moment, except for the muscles moving slightly at the corner of his mouth, he said in all seriousness, "What shall I tell her, Lars?" Lars exploded. "How do I know what you're to tell her? Tell her something to get rid of her. 3 days and three nights of this is beginning to get spooky." Blake turned back to the girl. She was standing easily, motionless, but looking at Blake inquiringly. They had an exchange. Once her brow furrowed and she glanced questioningly at Lars. Another, she lifted a long, graceful arm and pointed to the north, speaking rapidly. With one last long look at Lars, her nostrils flaring, she turned and strode with great steps and disappeared into the darkness. Lars sighed, letting all his pent-up breath out. Blake settled back with a satisfied grin, reaching for his drink, saying nothing. Then he started to laugh, a low, rumbling sound that grew higher and fairly convulsed him. Lars could stand it no longer. Rising and standing over Blake, he said impatiently, "For heaven's sake, Blake, tell me what you two were saying." Blake wiped his eyes with his handkerchief, trying to stop laughing. Penny and Alfred were giggling, and even Lars began to chuckle. Blake tried to speak, only to start laughing again. The Africans in the camp crept near, their grins making white hash marks across their dark faces. "I told her," Blake finally managed to say, "that you are of a different tribe, that in your tribe it was the custom for the girl's father to pay with cattle." He stopped to get his breath and wipe his eyes again. She had a lot of trouble understanding that, but finally accepted it. She said she would go and ask her father how many cattle he would pay for you. "Oh, no," groaned Lars. "What shall I do? I don't want the whole tribe on my hands. I'd advise, Blake responded, that you move your camp as early as possible in the morning toward the south. She said her people were camped 4 hours' walk to the north. 50 miles will get you well out of the way, and you'll be in the Salus where the hunting's good. They're not likely to follow since no natives are allowed there. I'll get word to your white hunter when we return to Dar, though I hate not finding out how many cattle they think you'd be worth. Blake started laughing again, and they all joined him. Isn't it rather unusual, Lars commented, for a young girl to be out on her own like that? It would be, Blake countered, for any other tribe, the Kikuyu, the Moran, and so on. But a young Maasai girl has a lot of latitude. Girls are a valuable property to the Maasai, but quite independent until marriage. She's allowed to do pretty much as she pleases, but will knuckle under later when she's married. They're a strange but magnificent people, Blake continued. Their god tells them, for instance, that all the cattle in the world belong to them. So when they raid the neighboring tribes of cattle, they're simply collecting what is their own. The Kenya and Tanzania governments cannot get them to assimilate nor come into the 20th century. They're nomads, cattle herders, and live on the blood from veins in their cows, laced with milk and a spot of urine to keep the milk from curdling. Penny gagged. What's going to happen to them, she asked. What really worries the government is not whether they survive. They're already shot through with venereal disease. But the health officers aren't running any penicillin out to them. For one thing, they can pierce the heart of a tree at 30 yards with a spear and intend to use for target practice anyone who tries to come at them with a hypodermic needle or a camera. What the government officials are really concerned with is the thousands of acres they run their cattle on that could be productive farmland. For this reason, along with others, they may just let the Maasai disappear. I've heard the men already are marrying out of the tribe because so many of their own women are sterile. Too bad, Lars said, glancing at his watch. He shook hands all around. Want to be sure we're all packed and on our way first thing tomorrow. Sorry we didn't get to chat about old times, Blake. Maybe another time.
That's good.
I'm interested in how your prose has changed since that travel book. I mean, it's really tightened up, and you know, all the excess. The only word that I would have tossed out there is expostulated, because that didn't seem to me to. I'm being picky, but I.
No, that's fine. That's what you need.
The rest of it really,
You do learn to write by writing. That's how you learn your craft. But it's a tremendous help to have someone who knows English literature and will read your manuscript and give you, not do your rewriting for you, but show you places where you can improve your own writing. It's a tremendous help, which I didn't have on the travel book and which I am getting on this.
Why, I guess I have a general question and a specific question, unless somebody else wants to butt in, but why do you write in the first place? And in the second place, why this specific story? I mean, for what are you writing? And don't say it's just money, because there are a lot of easier ways of making money.
Yeah, well, you hope to publish. I don't think most people would write unless it's a diary type of thing, unless they had some hopes of publishing, or unless they're geniuses. I'm not. The other thing is, I find I thoroughly enjoy it. I don't know when I have had such a good time. I'm thinking about what comes next in the story all the time. And as I'm walking, as I'm driving a car, as I'm doing mundane things. And then most of the time when I sit down to write and actually get into it, it starts to flow just like somebody dictating it to me. I've really done the writing in my head. Putting it down on paper is almost like taking dictation. And it's a very exciting thing to me. It also makes you much more observant. When you know you're going to write about something, you look at it with a new eye. And you'll ask that extra question, because you'll think, now when I get to this point, I won't know how to write this properly. Makes you much more keenly aware of sight, smell, sound, sensory perception, events, people, customs, makes what you do much richer, in my opinion.
Do you have a general idea, before you even begin putting it down on paper, of what the key of the story will be, or what it will center around? And then do you develop as you go along?
My instructor says never think beyond the next day's writing. However, I think you do have to have some idea of where you're headed. Now, you may change it completely, but at least you have some aim, some idea of general plot. The scenes themselves, you don't really think out until you start writing the actual scene, but the general plot, I think, has to go somewhere.
But if you want to lay the groundwork to it for a build-up, then you have to have a fairly good idea of what you want to get at, what should be the main thrust of your story.
I would say you need to know that you have something to say and what it is, even if it's just that you want to tell an interesting story. The other thing that happens that is strange, I didn't realize it till it happened to me, and that is somewhere in the early part of the book, the characters begin to control you. You may want something to happen, but the way you've built this character, he would not do this, and therefore the plot cannot take this turn. And you find yourself boxed in by the characters you've created. And you have to work your way around that box so that the novel doesn't seem to be manipulating or manipulative. I think that's a phoniness that comes through. You've got to let it flow naturally and go where it will go.
How long have you been into writing, even just for fun, without even thinking of publishing? How long have you been into writing?
Oh, several years. I've written a lot of short stories I wasn't able to get published. I've written some articles that I have been able to get published. One on scuba diving with underwater pictures. I suppose if I had to make a living at my writing, I would be writing more for the commercial market. Things that I knew I could sell before I wrote, for specific magazines who want specific types of articles. One writing instructor about 10 years ago told me that I would have to start out writing true romance stories and work up from that, and I just could not get interested in writing true romance, even to perfect my craft. But that's where a lot of people are learning their craft, is with that kind of writing. It just didn't interest me enough for me to discipline myself to do it.
Well, I've known Jane for 20 years, and she was a compulsive writer then. I can remember about your spiritual experience.
Yes, I wrote an article about our mission church that Doris started and brought me into.
And she stayed up all night writing that because she couldn't stop. So I think she is a compulsive writer and has been probably all her life.
The big problem, frankly, is after you learn how to write, in case you hopefully do, and that is getting published. It's extremely difficult today.
Well, it's just interesting to think about what you're thinking as you're writing. My fact is that you were a little probably okay and probably just fantasizing about it.
Yes.
You're somebody whose creativity wasn't in the child. She was free and let her imagination run.
I'd like to pursue that for a minute and have Doris, who is our preschool expert, talk about squelching creativity and fostering it. What?
You know,
because I know you believe that it is possible to do that.
Well, you know, it's interesting because tomorrow my little conversation over in Chalet 1 is going to be nurturing creativity. I think that you nurture it through allowing the child to express himself in unusual ways. Now, this is, some people think of creativity as being an artist, you know, as a child. That's all they can do. But language is also an area where you watch for fresh expressions. And then when you hear the child express himself in an unusual way, you hop onto that. Oh, say that again. I like that, the way you said that. For instance, the little boy who said, oh, look, the trees are all smiling at us when we were taking a walk. Well, right away, I copped onto that, and we got back to the school, and we talked about the smiling trees. And another child came in and said, and the little rabbit was running across the snow so fast his feet were just twinkling. And we talked about what a good word that was, twinkling feet. And I think you let the child feel free to express himself in his way and then say, that's good, I like that.
I take it you believe then that for most people somehow that gets stifled in the school system.
Definitely, and let's not just blame the teachers for that. We give too many children to each teacher. I mean, if a teacher could keep her class down to 15 or 20, I think she would have a real chance to nurture the creativity in each child. But when you stick her with 30 to 40 children, how in the world can she do the job and know each child and be able to capture those creative moments that each child expresses?
I think there's a clue too, Doris, in the word free that you use. Children feel free because they really haven't been programmed by our culture yet to repress themselves, and I think that's why they're creative. But by the time we get students as freshmen in college, they really have learned more from parents and from teachers and from society to non-communicate rather than to communicate.
That's right.
That is, they have learned that when somebody says, how are you, they are to reply, fine. It doesn't make any difference if they're dying or if they're sad or sick. Because that's a clue that the other person does not want to communicate.
Well, more and more, I am convinced that what children need is to feel enjoyed in the way they express themselves. I think they need response from parents, from teachers, a response to them as unique people and interesting people. And if they can feel that you're enjoying them in their wholeness and their unspoiledness before we get to them in the public school, you know, that to me is the best thing we can do for our children.
So in a way, you're really an advocate of the second way, that is, that somehow a teacher is really a teacher who gets out of the way.
That's right.
And is not a policeman and
but can also nurture the awareness that Jean was talking about, so that the children become aware of their surroundings, and also help them with the words that will describe their sensations in beautiful, interesting ways.
When you say, Doris, to the child, that's bad.
You don't say that's bad.
Well, it seems to me your example is twinkling feet. First one, we're creative because they name the moment for all people. They communicated whatever one was feeling. And there will be times when that person stands alone and no one's going to say that's good. There's no advance made. It wasn't creative.
What do you make of the argument that it's good simply because the child himself thinks it's good?
I think there could be some kind of objective criteria besides
that is the real problem, isn't it? Doris just said, who's the judge? You're saying there has, somewhere along the line, there has to be a judge.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I certainly wouldn't want to be the judge. Let me out of that job.
But then, you see, maybe you want them to teach because you're just...
Well, we're all judges, you know. You don't just advocate responsibility. We have standards. There's a good house and there's a bad house.
I mean, this is that Greek...
Well-built car and a poorly built car.
This is where every freshman English teacher is.
I'm not talking about mechanics.
Oh, I think so. I think you can draw a direct analogy there. With the world
with
of
a
art
car and a child.
With the world of art and the world of more mundane things. This is something I try to struggle with as a musician, to see what is good music and to try and describe musical things, aesthetic things, to people who have seemingly little flair for it, people who are mechanics or plumbers, electricians.
And Doris, you would...
The only way I can talk to them is to say, look, there is a good way to do a plumbing job, there's a lousy way.
Some
apple pies are better than other apple pies.
Absolutely, there's a recipe, but there's not a recipe for expression.
Creative expression. Mm-hmm. Maybe the difference between what you're saying and Doris, you're saying about the same thing in a different way. You're saying how a good creative expression is one which accurately depicts whatever is being described, whether the thing described is good or bad, right? And what she's saying, we shouldn't decide whether the thing described is good or bad, but we both, I think both would be, well, if what you want to judge on is accuracy of description, and she, I don't know what she wants to judge on, but she doesn't want to judge at all.
We have a freshman text, and I really wish I would have brought it, because it's right at the heart of this whole controversy. It says in its introduction to the teacher, giving a student a C on a paper is telling him he's a C person, and who is so arrogant as to do that? If his mind, if he thinks in choppy, in a choppy logical fashion, why does his writing have to be logical and organized? Why can't his writing be choppy? Why does he have to write in complete sentences? Putting a red mark on the paper is stifling that child, is judging the child, and it is repressing, you know, the beautiful flower that could blossom if you got out of the way and said, you know, wow, it's your thing, do it the way you want.
Then should you just leave them with a piece of paper and a pencil in their home?
Right.
Forget all.
Right.
You don't even care whether it's good or bad.
You
or
care.
Or what, done well.
You care, but you don't. But you're not trying to get the child. And I am the worst person to ask what side I'm on, because one minute I'm on one side of this and one side I'm on the other, and I just go around and around these freshman texts.
Well, I do think there's a time that a child needs some basics, but I certainly don't think that it's in the preschool years, and I'm concerned with early childhood. That's my specialty.
Yeah, but this is college level now, and they're doing the same thing, you see, saying, no, what you want to do is fire the student up to write. We had a freshman English teacher, and the most successful course he ever taught was, he had a theory. He was a coach to a track coach, a really successful track coach, and he taught halftime track and English. And he had the idea that you could fire a freshman English class up by using the same techniques that a coach uses in a locker room. You know, like get those guys to go out and kill the other team and so forth. And I said, well, I don't think that's going to work, because writing is one thing, and you know, and team's another. 2 weeks later, I saw him walking down toward the union. He had his arm around the student, and he was saying, "Now, what I want you to write is." And the student was going, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." Okay. Well, he didn't have to make any rules. He didn't have to say, "Do this, do that." He had that student so wanting to write that the student wrote, convinced, you know, that the student could say something and wanted to say something.
I can remember in high school and college when I got my English themes back. They still call them themes. There were all the little red marks on punctuation, spelling, etc. But seldom, if ever, any comment on the content. Mm-hmm. No help with that. No idea that the teacher had even been aware of the content. All she was really looking for was...
Well, it's safer to correct the punctuation. But see, Barb Collins was talking a couple of weeks ago at a session, after a session, about the frustration she feels with the teachers that are teaching her kids now, who are in junior high. About, Barb would say, well, how come you don't correct these comma mistakes? How come you don't correct their spelling? The teacher says, well, that's not my responsibility. English teacher is saying that, see? But maybe, I don't know. I mean, I literally don't know, because we are in such a... Apparently, what we've been doing since 63 is not working as far as the tests are concerned. Now, are the board scores, the average, the verbal score on the board scores of entering college freshmen last year alone went down 10 points. And in the last 10 years, it has gone down 40 points nationwide. And, you know, are we going to be reading at the 8th grade level? If we are, then this kind of free writing is really wrong. Then the Greeks are right, and somehow you have to pound it in.
We have a compromise between the two, where use the
latest, beat them one day and love them the next.
Positive reinforcement along with good discipline. When I student taught sophomore English in high school, I was really appalled at, you know, I'd give a writing assignment and some kids would write it out once. I mean, they wouldn't even, their first draft and hand it in. You know, I never would have done that. I mean, probably most of you never would have even thought of just writing something once, let alone at least you would have made it look nice. And this happened time and time again where they just, they don't have the basic skills. And, you know, even how to put a sentence together. And it seems to me that you can fire them up at the same time and yet also say, you know, look it, you got to learn how to write a sentence and you've got to learn, because when we communicate, you know, we're a society, and when we're communicating, we have to have structure for that communication. If we just, you know, if it's do your own thing, then I can say, I can, you know, drop all my verbs out, and, you know, all kinds of things could happen. You got to have that organization, but I think you can also stimulate creativity at the same time. I don't think they have to be one or the other.
I had a very fascinating experience with sort of what you're talking about as a lay reader for an English teacher, because our students in high school were, you know, just weren't getting through the English courses in college, so they decided to do something about this by having lay readers. And I studied journalism, never taught or anything, and that sort of interfered with correcting English papers. But it was my job to read what the kid had written, to make the corrections, or not corrections, but note where there was misspelling and mispunctuation, so I did put red marks on the paper, but then to comment on what the kid had written. And it was just fascinating. The first, three assignments that came back, the first one really startled me to see what I was dealing with. The second, just, it was really a response from those kids because somebody had paid attention to what they were saying. And it just kept coming and coming. And I comment about, you know, sometime when you're sitting in, the one silly example, when you're sitting in the car, practice making, or when you're waiting for your girl, practice making R's, you know. This kid, pretty soon you could read his R's. It was really
haven't you hit in just in at least a phrase in the gist of what you've been saying on a way around John's problem of trying to bring both together? I mean, show that you care.
Yeah, that's what it did. If I was concerned with what they were saying, and when the way they wrote interfered with what they were trying to say, then that's what we dealt with.
Well, I think really it's an insult to a child's intelligence to assume that he doesn't want to be corrected. Mm-hmm. I think children go to school to learn. I mean, a good majority of them, more than we give them credit for. And they're there to be corrected, and they want to be corrected.
I think that, I mean, that, you know, if you sit down and talk with a freshman who is a bad speller, they are not terribly proud of it either. Let's...
But now, this doesn't apply to preschoolers. I still say they have to be free.
Okay, at what point do you start saying that's a terrible sentence or that's a terrible metaphor?
Oh, you don't ever say that.
Oh, you don't ever say that.
Terrible.
I do all the time.
I think this is the point she's bringing out. Recognize them as people, and you can certainly talk to them in a decent way.
I think recognize them as people is being able to say that's terrible or that stinks.
You don't say they're terrible.
Yeah, I don't understand.
Your students are mature enough to take advantage.
Well, they know me too, I think. Yeah.
Well, this is it. If you have a relationship with a kid, he knows how you are.
Yeah.
He'll tolerate your insults. Because he knows you love him. You know, just like a parent.
Except for there was a colleague of mine, of whom I am not proud at all, gave on a theme, sixth theme, from some guy who was just having a terrible time in freshman English. He wrote, "Congratulations, this is by far the best theme you've ever written." F.
Yeah.
F. And I guess it was an F theme. The guy, it was a higher F than he'd ever done. But that as funny a comment as that is, I think that is a piece of writing is no place for that kind of.
Well, that's facetious. He's being funny at the expense of the students.
Yeah, I think. Writing is a very personal thing. Yeah. And Doris is right. It's so easy to stifle it. And if we have to err, I guess I would agree with Doris that we err on the side of permissiveness, because our culture will take care of knocking things into shape. I mean,
you are
the model.
That's right.
If we use colorful language and expressive words, they're going to model us. We're going to model them for them.
I think parents tend to overestimate the effect of a school on a child and underestimate the effect of the home. A school cannot do much harm if the education in the home is going. I mean, it can do some harm, but school children survive an amazing amount of bad education.
Also, the period of time before they get to school,
birth to sixth. Well, Doris is hitting preschool, and I think that's a lot of it is set right there. Let's end. The session is about to run out with some poems about Holden. We might as well end on a creative note rather than on a divisive note. But this is a discussion I would like to continue with some of you, and because the more ideas I get, the more I'm going to be able to cope with it. Freshmen are writing awfully badly, and I don't think English teachers know much more anymore about what to do. I mean, we are really in a quandary, and I suppose that's part of the confusion that you're feeling as parents about your English classes. Go ahead.
I'd like to read a couple of different styles. This is a little one I wrote last visit after we had a really great discussion on being male and human. Maybe some of you have seen those discussions. I call it celebration. Today, celebration, liberation from shrouded feelings of calloused living. A new beginning, joy, new awareness, having turned a new page, discovering feelings, care that was always there, but not fully known, admitted, recognized, or felt, care I did not dare to express or share. Now I am learning, discerning, patience, feeling. Sometimes I'm afraid, for feelings are fragile, but risks are worth taking, for feelings may sometimes be just as valid as reason. How much better to be unreservedly feeling than unfeelingly reserved. And then I'd like to share the one I call my Holden hymn. I wrote this on the way home from the visit here last summer, when I was still feeling really high from the experience and in the midst of that re-entry, driving across the deserts of southern Idaho and northern Utah. It was my first experience of writing a poem to an existing tune. I'm very interested in music, and I like to study some more poetry to maybe go on in the direction of writing songs. But an old chorale tune came into my mind that I learned as a boy. Wrote this to that tune. And this is just simply my description of the experience at Holden. From the desert mounds and flowers,
from the traffic noise estranged. From our cornfields and our classrooms to the cascade trails we ranged, came we with our needs deep-seated, filled with doubt and faith depleted. Quest for caring revelation to repair a bruised foundation. Here in Holden's mountain grandeur, we were found by hearts that care, touched by loving arms and folded, God's surrounding love to bear. Pines and glacier stones bear witness of this truth, His ever nearness. Living water, rediscovery, great beholden, love, recovery.
She's allowed to just stay on the road.
Well, this is some of the strange, wide open stretches.
I wish that you would let Beanie see that and see if he can locate a tune.
It's down there.
Well, he has a tune.
I
wrote it to that existing tune. I had the tune in my head when I was writing.
I see.
I just wrote two new stanzas to that old hymn.
Great. Well, is it in the songbook? And
it's the tune, as I knew it,
in the dining hall,
in the old Concordia hymnal, to the dearest Jesus, draw down near me. It's a similar, it's almost the same exact tune as Jesu, joy of man's desiring, but it's a different meter. It's in 4/4 times the 3/4.
Mm. Yeah, that would be a good one for the music book in the dining hall.
I like that phrase, bruised foundation.
Yeah. I like your use of those Latinate words like foundation, along with a lot of them. I mean, you balance the simple words and the Latinate words together really well.
Are there some more that want to contribute?
Does anybody else have? We didn't ask anybody to necessarily to bring anything. I think it's about 5 minutes until Vespers, and that was a good one. But maybe we could continue the session, and at least we can all descend on Doris tomorrow.